you know, all these many weeks of hard effort, everything we've accomplished can be said in, you know, 7.5 pages. You look at the price you paid per word, and it's a pretty steep price. And so I want to make sure that there's more to what you've learned than what is reflected in this brief outline. And I hope it's sort of the tip of the iceberg. But I give it to you because I want to encourage you to kind of differentiate the important stuff, or the more important stuff from the less important stuff. Not that everything else is unimportant, but rather kind of prioritize stuff and also kind of synthesize it, put it together, give it a kind of coherent whole. And oftentimes that's what makes it difficult for you to do a good analysis of a problem, is that you're having trouble putting the whole package together, not that you're going to have mountains of details, but it's sort of prioritizing and putting in the right order. So that's why I give you this outline. And the other reason I give it to you is hopefully you've been doing some of this yourself. You've been writing your own outline as you go along. There should be more out there someplace. Yeah, if there are extras, yeah, move them that way. I always sort of misjudge how many I need. That I hope you will take this and compare it to your own notes. And then part of what we will do tomorrow is to identify discrepancies between the way I've expressed something and the way you've expressed it. And in many cases, they will simply be stylistic differences. You say potato, I say potato. But there's no substantive difference. In other cases, you say potato, I say tomato. Well, there really is a difference there, even though things sound sort of similar. So you want to find areas where you can mix and, you know, just say, gee, you've got three elements here, I've got two elements, or you say it this way, I say it that way. I'm not sure whether I'm just saying it a different way or whether I'm missing something here. So again, I want to spend time tomorrow having you look at this outline, and if you find anything that doesn't jive with the way you've got it, bring that to my attention and we'll try to straighten that out. Any other questions about the outline, Mr. Lynch?
Chris, the things that we get to use on the test, is that it?
No. Alas. And, you know, even at that, what I give you is something not completely dissimilar from that. Mr. Rubio, if I may borrow your copy of it here, there's something, and I'll actually post it, or maybe I'll even hand it out tomorrow. I think I'll hand it out tomorrow. But it's this three-page, I call it a shrunken outline. I take the sort of full-page flowchart kind of deals, this visual outline, and then I just shrink it into the space that will fit on three pages to save a few trees. And I will include that on the exam. So you'll have the regular exam, and then the last three pages will be that shrunken outline. And the reason I do it is more as a security blanket. I do it with the same trepidation that I give you the outline that will wind up giving you a seductive sense of confidence or whatever when you should act as though it weren't really there. I don't think in the course of actually writing the exam you're going to get much out of having those three pages of flowcharts on there. Either you've taken that and put it in your head and you're using it as you go through the exam, reading it and so forth, or if it's not there, simply finding it on the piece of paper is not going to help you a whole lot. Where it does, you know, somebody asked me to do it once, and once I did it, it's kind of hard to stop doing it. But again, it's more of a security blanket. Gee, if I suffer complete brain freeze, I'll have something that'll sort of jumpstart my motor. Oh yeah, that's right. But but it's not useful to you unless it's already reflecting stuff. You should basically have this, I would say, you should basically have this visual outline or something like it in your head already before you. Now, this is not particularly relevant, but I teach other classes where I give open book exams. This isn't one of them, obviously. there are different kinds of exams, and sort of using the statutes as a sort of modified open book. You know, it's less remembering stuff and being able to apply it than it is being able to look stuff up. And there's a different kind of skill that lawyers have, which is looking stuff up and reading and making sense of it. But in any event, such it is. Yes, Mr. Gallo.
If you have a chance to post that.
Okay, yeah, the shrunken outline. And it's actually out there someplace. As some of you have found it, I just haven't moved it, migrated it. I'll send you an email to where the link is. I'll actually put it on the web and then give you a link to where it is on the web. It'll be a Microsoft Word file, actually. Yeah. Other questions or issues? Okay, let's do our last little run here at Brown versus U.S. I've referred to this before, and I am quite fond of this case precisely because it shows you how reasonable minds can reach different conclusions about the application of principles to a particular case. And the other thing I like about Brown versus U.S., but which is potentially confusing, is the intermixture of two different kinds of issues, two different chapters, really. There's a Chapter 11 issue in Brown versus U.S., but there's also a Chapter 4 issue about sovereign immunity. And the court uses both, but it doesn't clearly signal when it's switched gears from talking about one issue to talking about the other. But I want you, as you analyze a fact pattern on the exam, to identify those issues, particularly where it involves the actions of a government or the inactions of a government agency. I want you to be able to identify, well, this is a duty of care issue, and this is a sovereign immunity issue. But let's talk about the case, and then we'll be able to clarify that. The last chance to recite a case here. Summer will be over at this conclusion of this case here. Well, then I'll do it. You paid all this tuition money. All right. So the facts are relatively simple. The plaintiffs are the widows of these fishermen who go sailing over the bounding sea, they do so after listening to a weather report. And the weather report says, in effect, gee, it's going to be windy out there, fresh winds or something like that, strong winds, but they're fishermen, they're used to it. They go out there and they hit the perfect storm. And this howling wind and huge seas, and their little boat capsizes, sort of like the movie The Perfect Storm, and three of these guys drown. Their widows then sue the United States, under the Federal Tort Claims Act, claiming that the government negligently, in effect, lured them to their death by giving them a bad weather report. And as they investigate, do the discovery of the case, prepare it for trial, they discover, lo and behold, the Weather Service actually was doing without a weather buoy. They had one. They'd stuck out in the wild Atlantic Ocean to give them a data point. And as you do weather forecasting, apparently you take all the data from all these different places and run it through your computer and use that to predict the weather for the future. And they're not getting data out of this place, and the experts tell the plaintiff's lawyers and in turn tell the judge, gee, if they'd had this thing working, it would have made a much better weather forecast and these guys could have stayed out of the storm and survived. Now, the plaintiffs want to utilize a precedent, the Indian towing case, to say our case is like the Indian towing case, which is a, I guess Indian towing was some kind of barge company. They were sailing over the bounding main when, following charts issued by the government, they are charting their course, trying to figure out where they are, and are using a reference point where there is a lighthouse and waiting for that lighthouse to come in view, and boom, they hit this rock in the middle of as they're going along because the lighthouse isn't working. So they say, hey, government, you were negligent. And the government's response in Indian Towing was, we don't owe you a duty. If we want to have a lighthouse, we'll have a lighthouse, but if we don't want to have a lighthouse, we won't. And if we want to keep it lit, we will, and if we don't, we won't. Go jump in the lake. And the plaintiff says, no, it's not quite like that. It would be one thing if you chose not to have a lighthouse, but when you have a lighthouse and you, in particular, distribute maps that show the location of this lighthouse, and then the sailors rely on this, in fact, justifiably rely on it. Where there is justifiable reliance by the plaintiff on the defendant's promise, in effect, then you're in trouble. And the court, Supreme Court in Indian Towing, says the government's liable for negligently allowing this lighthouse to burn out. Now, maybe they were using reasonable care, maybe they weren't, but the point is the government owed a duty once they issued these maps. Okay, so the plaintiff in Brown versus U.S. is trying to analogize to bootstrap themselves into the holding of Indian Towing and say, our case is just like that in this respect. If you don't want to have a weather service, that's fine. But if you supply this information and the local news channels pick it up and they broadcast latest forecast from the United States Weather Service, fresh winds, you know, gusting to whatever it is, so forth. Then you've done exactly the same thing as the government did in Indian Towing, and you owe a duty to make sure that that's reasonably accurate. And we'll, you know, we'll be happy to go through the standard of reasonable care, and the government's only held to that, but they are held to a standard of reasonable care. They can't simply say, go jump in the lake. The trial judge bought that argument. The trial judge thought that the issuance of weather forecasts from the Weather Service was analogous to issuing maps in Indian Towing, held the government liable, and awarded damages to the widows. Government obviously appealed it. And the Court of Appeals takes the same issue and has a different view. The government, or the Court of Appeals says, look, the standard is justifiable reliance. If you get a map from the maritime agency or what have you, a government-issued map that shows a lighthouse, a person justifiably relies on that. Lighthouses don't move, and that's something. What reasonable person would rely on a weather forecast? Everybody knows that predicting the weather is an uncertain business. There's no justifiable reliance. Did they in fact rely? Well, yes, they did, but it's not justifiable. So this term, justifiable, is a qualifier that allows the judge to in effect say, did the defendant, particularly, did the defendant induce justifiable reliance? And to try to connect this with the, as we're coming to the end of part three here, the connecting link here is that this begins to look a lot like a contract. Was there a meeting of the minds? Did the defendant offer something and the plaintiff, in effect, accepted it? If so, if we sort of have this deal, the defendant was free not to make the deal, but if the defendant sticks their neck out, the plaintiff can accept the deal and then the defendant's on the hook. Now again, the trial judge, no dummy, says, looks good to me, I think there's justifiable reliance here. The Court of Appeals says, no, we don't see justifiable reliance. Now, there's a second issue in this case that I want to make sure, as I said before, that is distinct from the question about justifiable reliance. This distinct issue has to do with sovereign immunity. That is, the fact that the government is a defendant makes a difference in this case. You could just as easily have had the same lawsuit filed against the station that, or the radio station that broadcasts the report. And you could have the question as I drive north on Hamilton turning into Nevada to go home, and I see a big billboard with these, smiling faces, Channel 4 News, news you can count on. Oh yeah? Would I justifiably rely on their weather forecast? That the temperatures tomorrow are going to be in the mid-30s, okay, that's above freezing. I can go, traveling on the highways and not slide off the road. Well, lo and behold, there's a cold front that moves in that they didn't warn me about. The roads are frozen. I slide off the road and hit a tree. Can I sue Channel 4? News you can count on? Again, that's an issue about whether there's justifiable reliance. Would a person justifiably say, oh, I won't put my snow tires on? Or would a reasonable person, well, that's their weather forecast, but we know the weather forecasts are all kind of, by guess and by gosh. Now, the government, unlike Channel 4, has an additional argument which says, we're the government, you can't sue us if what we're doing falls within a discretionary function. When we decided to use or not use the information from this buoy out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, when we decided that we were sick of throwing good money after bad trying to repair it, and we'll just limp along without that information, was that something that is a discretionary function, or is that an operational function? Remember going back to Channel 4, not Channel 4, Freudian slip there, going back to Chapter 4, that we distinguished between policy-making functions on the one hand, which are immune, and operational decisions, which are not immune. You can sue the government when they mess up doing the things they've already decided to do, but you can't sue them for bad policy decisions they've made. And it's often difficult to tell the difference. And I use this case as an example, and here it is again. The trial judge said it would be one thing if they decided we don't need this weather buoy out there. That's a policy-making decision. But when they decided they needed it, but then in Keystone Cops fashion, they couldn't seem to get their act together to actually make it work. Well, that's not a policy-making decision. That's just negligence. That's just a blunder. And the Court of Appeals took a very different view of it. Again, Court of Appeals doesn't clearly distinguish how much of their opinion relies upon the duty of care issue and how much relies upon the sovereign immunity issue. They sort of weave them together to explain why they're reversing the judgment and denying the plaintiff's claim. But the argument here is that the Court of Appeals thinks is persuasive is, look, what more central aspect of policymaking is there than deciding where your resources are going to be spent? If they kept throwing good money after bad, bleeding money they needed elsewhere in the weather, U.S. Weather Service, on this stupid buoy out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, kept blowing, you know, breaking its tether and so forth, well, if they decided that wasn't worth doing, who are we, the courts, to superimpose our judgment in place of their policy-making judgment? Now, again, I present this case to you in part to temper your desire for dispositive answers. You want to have a rule, you apply the rule, you get a conclusion. That's what your client is looking for. Your client doesn't want, well, there's a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Your client wants a definitive answer. You're going to win, you're going to lose. And you're right to be in search of everything you can find that will give you definitive answers. But you have to temper that with the acknowledgement that I can't promise something where reasonable people might take different views. If I gave you the facts of this case on the exam, something like them, I would hope that you would look at them and say, gee, this is one where I could see the government's position, I could see the plaintiff's position. And if you take the government's position, you could find that there was a discretionary function here. You could find that there was no justifiable reliance. On the other hand, you could take the plaintiff's position. A court could wind up saying that the plaintiff did justifiably rely on this and that the government was not making a policy-making judgment but simply failed to carry out with reasonable care policy they previously adopted. Both of those positions are quite reasonable. And so you should be, again, able to kind of handle that degree of ambiguity as you look at a fact pattern and say, I wonder how this would turn out. Again, the main thing I want you to do is not to collapse the two issues together. I want you to identify separately the issue of this is a duty of care issue. This is a case in which the government did not blow this, did not sink this boat. The worst you can say about the government is they didn't help prevent it. That's why this case is in Chapter 11. And you want to make sure as you read the fact pattern on the exam, do I have a Chapter 11 issue? Is this a case where the defendant, at worst, could be said to have failed to help? Or is this a case in which the defendant actually made matters worse? The defendant sold the product that injured the plaintiff. The defendant released some bad guy into the environment. The defendant did something. It was the defendant's action that caused the harm. Then you don't have a Chapter 11 issue. You may have other issues, undoubtedly you will, but it's not a Chapter 11 issue. However, where you have an issue, where you have a case in which a defendant could be said at worst to have failed to help, Then I got to talk about the Chapter 11 issue, which is to say, do I either have justifiable reliance, where the defendant has kind of lured the plaintiff into relying on the defendant's continuation or help? That's one justifiable reliance. The other thing is to say we've got this special relationship, as you had in Tarasov, where the defendant knows about the plaintiff, has some relationship to the plaintiff, such as, this is the girlfriend of my patient. Again, the doctor in Tarasov clearly owes a duty to the patient. Podar could sue the doctor saying, doctor, I came to you and told you how completely wacko I was. Your job was to keep me from harming myself or other people, and you failed. You gave some wimpy instructions to the security people. I was out of my mind. Now that I've been medicated properly, I'm a much better person. In fact, I was listening to the Mark Furman show, so I was driving around town the other day, and he was talking about there was a case of a woman who was, I think, just being released from Eastern State Hospital or someplace. She had killed her daughter, and I think her other daughter was fighting like crazy to prevent her from... She actually had gotten a big settlement from the drug company that... I forget what the drug company did. It wasn't the drug company, it was a pharmacist. Pharmacist filled the wrong prescription or didn't warn her about something. I forget what the relationship is, but somehow she gets money because she says, I was crazy and you didn't do anything to help me. And the daughter, the surviving daughter, thought her mother was a criminal and ought to be punished, but her attitude was, I'm just one sick puppy and you didn't help me when I needed help. So, again, the in Tarasov, Podar is eventually convicted of a crime, of murder. He's not held to be mentally ill. You could certainly have a case in which the person is found to be mentally ill, and then it's, you know, a duty to that person. They're not bad, they're sick. And a doctor's there to help people who are sick. So if you owe a duty to your patient to prevent this from occurring, why don't you owe a duty to the victim? That's a sort of an easy, that's where Tarasov wants to kind of keep pulling you over here, extending this duty of care. It's not such a radical concept. Go with it. This is an area of intense public scrutiny, as I said before, because of the kinds of cases that emerge. I just got a call yesterday from an old... one of my first partners, a guy I officed next to. Anyway, I think I mentioned this case before. He represented the girls who were placed with this foster parent who was a child molester, and they never asked him about a criminal record, and he had a criminal record for attempted rape. And he proceeds to sexually molest these kids, and the girls sue the state. The case that eventuated from that, the name of which actually now escapes me, but in any event, the case, he went through five or six different dismissals and appeals and so forth. He finally got up to the Washington Supreme Court. Washington Supreme Court ruled against him, said the state child protective service workers are immune. You cannot sue them for their negligence in placing people in foster care. Bob wouldn't take no for an answer. He filed a motion to reconsider, which has about as much likelihood in general as filing a motion with me to reconsider my grades. Theoretically possible, but, you know, it's probably not worth the paper it's written on. He won. He got the Supreme Court to reconsider. They reheard the case and said, oh, on second thought, they don't enjoy absolute immunity. They lose that immunity if they're negligent. The Attorney General then was really ticked off The Attorney General files a motion to reconsider the reconsideration. It's all true. It's like a bizarre... The Attorney General says, hey, wait a second, court. What good is immunity if I lose it if I'm negligent? I don't need it if I'm not...